Everybody, I'm Nathan. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you. I never stop to drink while I'm talking, Mark. I always wonder about those speakers who get up. The first thing they do is take a sip of water. Thank you. Can't be thirsty then. But anyway, I was just sitting there looking at this podium, and I was thinking, I just built a new podium for my home group. Meets on Wednesday night, and I thought the High Desert group has a nicer podium than the Pacific group has. Well, I'm the youngest of six kids, so I'm naturally hyper-competitive. And I thought, well, looks like the PG's getting a new podium. Anyway, I can't be outdone by the High Desert group. Anyway, enjoy it while it lasts. Happy to be here tonight. Happy to be sober. Thank you for having me. Tracy asked me to speak, but haven't seen her here tonight. I don't know. Anyway, ask her about that later. But a very friendly group, nice, kind of welcoming. You got one super enthusiastic greeter over there. This guy here, right here, yeah. He likes his job. Anyway, thank you. It's nice to make new people feel welcome. It's a good, you know, we all feel kind of goofy and weird coming into AA. And it's nice to be greeted. It's nice to have a meeting that kind of shows a little respect to the speaker. You know, I got ADD. I'm a little wacky. So when people are moving around and looking at their phone, it's hard for me to focus. But really, I think the most important thing is we're setting examples for new people, right? So, you know, I started a meeting the day the lockdown came out for COVID. I sent out a text to like 20 of my friends, and we had a meeting. We met twice a week in my backyard, and I wrote the format. It's a step and tradition meeting. And we moved into Ohio Street on Tuesday night because that kind of meeting, that meeting never came back after COVID. And there's a kid in there, you know, he's got like 3 years and he's on his phone and he's, you know, just scrolling through his Instagram feed. And, you know, I look at him, I'm like, give him the sign. And he gives me that look, you know, like, you want to fight kind of look, you know. And I said to him, you know, he's all ready to go after the meeting. I go, you know why I asked you to put your phone away? And he's like, yeah, giving me some shit. And I go, there's a kid with 12 days behind you staring at your Instagram feed thinking, if you can look at your Instagram, why shouldn't I look at my Instagram? And he might miss what he needs to hear at the podium that night. You know, so I personally leave my phone in the car. I'm not that important. People can be without me for 90 minutes while I'm in an AA meeting. Even though it's off, it's pinging and buzzing. And, you know, I got ESPN alerts and all those kind of things going on. It's just a distraction. And, you know, like when I was new, I didn't understand Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I'm a very cynical guy. Like I said, I'm the youngest of six. So I just got thumped on all the time. I got four older brothers beating me up every day. And we might talk about that later. But I would come in here and I would think like, hey, like what is AA? It's like, it's not real, right? It's not like, it's like, you know, keep coming back. It works, you know. And I was a pretty smart kid. I read really fast, and my memory is fading a little bit. But back then, I could quote the book and the literature. And to ask the old timers, I'd say, what's it? And they'd say, read chapter 5. And I said, I don't want to know how it works. I want to know what is it. Like, keep coming back. It works. Define it for me. What's it? I want to know what Alcoholics Anonymous is. You know, I was a pain in the ass. They couldn't really answer me. They just said, keep coming back, kid. And it didn't seem real to me. Like, we come here, bunch of dopes telling stories. Half of them aren't true from the podium. They're just trying to podium killers and stuff, you know. And it's like it just didn't seem, intellectually, I couldn't put the two together, right? And it's my personal opinion that many, 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 many people fail in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I say fail, I mean go out and drink. They drink in Alcoholics Anonymous because AA cannot be intellectualized. I cannot explain it to you. AA can only be experienced, right? AA can only be experienced by working the steps and practicing these principles in all our affairs. The problem is when I'm new, I need a girlfriend, I need some money, I need a car, I need a place to stay, and I need a gym membership. I don't need to write an inventory or to make amends to some people I'm never going to see again, right? I don't need to do that. I need to fix my living situation now, right? And so I could never, like, connect, like, how is taking these actions going to fix my life? Like, you know, when I came in, I had a bicycle that was, couldn't sell it for 10 bucks. You didn't need to lock it. Nobody would steal it. And I had a pillowcase with some clothes in it. I was homeless, not a long time homeless, but I was literally had nowhere to sleep that night. Nobody would take a collect call. So I got sober February 16th, 1985. So I've been sober 39 years. It's funny, when I got sober, there were no cell phones. There were no pagers. Like, the phones were attached to a wall, right? And so you could, there were pay phones that you put a quarter in and you could call somebody, right? And so you could do a collect call if you didn't have the money. So you'd call up and they'd say, collect call from Nathan Dixon, will you accept the charges? And they'd say, nope, and hang up. So I had nowhere to go. I had absolutely nowhere to go. And I needed stuff in my life. You know, I needed a place to stay. I needed a couple hundred bucks. And I didn't need somebody talking to me about the steps. So, but what happened was I was desperate. So I came in here and it kind of worked. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about my story because you don't need to hear my theories and opinions, right? So here's my story. It goes something like this. I grew up in Northeast New Jersey, Bergen County. I'm the youngest of six kids. I got four older brothers, one older sister. My dad died. He had 48 years of sobriety. I have two brothers who are sober. One's going to turn 40 years sober July 5th. The other one's class of 87. I'm not sure when his AA anniversary is. He don't really go to too many meetings anyway, so he's kind of half measuring it. I got one brother who's 63 years old. He's been in five treatment centers in 3 years. And I have another brother who's worse off than he is behind drinking. So it's brutal to see the one guy drinking. I talked to him. He's a great guy. He was the best man at my wedding. I know about getting sober. I know about alcoholism. I know about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can't get my own brother sober, right? It's kind of, you know, you just can't. If he's not ready, he's not ready. But he knows I'm sober. So anyway, I grew up in this house. My mother divorced my father. It's my oldest brother went to Harvard Business School. When he was there, he sent us copies out of the law books that my parents' divorce case went to the Supreme Court of the United States of America. So everything above a superior court is an appellate court. And so he appealed the divorce. My mother was granted a divorce. My father appealed that divorce all the way to the New Jersey State Supreme Court. And then he appealed it to the United States Supreme Court. They did not hear the case, but they wrote a decision which upheld the lower court, the New Jersey State Supreme Court. So like Dixon versus Dixon in 1970, it's a little famous Dixon history there. But so finally the divorce was final, and that was my dad's sobriety date. A little bit of alcoholic irony. My father had an undergrad, a master's, a law degree. He passed the law in a blackout, and then he got a PhD in law, and they called it an LLM back then. 3 years after this advanced law degree from New York NYU Law School, he was drinking wine out of a paper bag in an alleyway that me and my friends used to drink in later, actually. But just a total rock bottom alcoholic. So there was a guy who I met, this old Irish guy. I used to pick him up every Wednesday night drunk and bring him to the Park Ridge Group, Park Ridge, New Jersey. And he'd tell me the stories. He'd say, sometimes your father would be quiet. Sometimes he would get a little loud. We'd have to take him. He'd have to leave the meeting. 3 years, they took him to that meeting drunk every week, and he finally got sober. When the divorce was final, my mother, who should be in the Hall of Fame of Mothers, her father, my grandfather, very wealthy, wouldn't give her any money. And my father, I don't know if he had any money at the time, but if he did, he wouldn't give it to her. They tried to pressure her financially to get back into the marriage. My mother worked two jobs. She worked a bookkeeping job during the day and a waitressing job at night because she wouldn't do it their way and raise six kids on her own. Just an unbelievable effort on her part. And my sister was never around. She's normal. It's funny. My sister's non-alcoholic. almost like my guardian angel growing up, but we were five of the most rotten little bastards you could imagine. We were just rotten, just bad, bad, bad kids, right? And so I'll tell you just a little bit about it, because 9:15 will be here before you know it. So my mother worked these two jobs. She was never around. My father could not come around the house. He only got us on Sunday. And my brother Mike, who I'm sure has spoken out here before, he was like a real drug dealer, not like the little drug dealers. He was a legit drug dealer. And so we would be down, all the houses have basements back east because of the frost line, but they're like low. They're like kind of 6.5 feet. You got to kind of squat down. And some Puerto Rican from the Bronx, Louis Rodriguez, he graffitied the whole basement with Looney Tune characters and drug depictions. So like Bugs Bunny shooting up, Daffy Duck hitting a bong, you know, just Porky Pig just drinking. And it was like strobe lights and black light posters and just rock and roll. And just every minute of every day, somebody was in our basement getting wasted, right? Like there was drinking and drug use down there all the time. And Mike was selling drugs. He'd be here like, you know, midnight. There'd be like, we're receiving stolen merchandise constantly for drugs, trading it for drugs all the time. And so we're just down there drinking and getting loaded. And that's the environment. That's my home. That's my childhood home. And that's a good part of my home. Since I like you guys, I'll tell you this one story. I tell some of the stories of us growing up, which there's not enough time. You're not going to get a lot of them tonight. But when we tell them, sometimes even me saying them, I think, no way these happened. Like this stuff didn't happen. It must be some fabrication or something. So once my mother stabbed my brother in the back, buried a knife in his back. So my mother was in and out of, she couldn't take it. She was in and out of psychiatric hospitals and would go away for like 6 months at a time. My father would come. He was a total Catholic guy. He'd say, he had all this guilt. So he'd say, you know what's right, you know what's wrong. When you die, you'll meet your creator, pay for your sins then, which to us was like, sweet, we get to do whatever we want now, right? So we'll worry about God later. We're going to get wasted today. So a friend of mine, Greg Holy, who he kind of would always say, like, no way, but, you know, Mike and me, he would always get the story from me, then ask a couple of my brothers, like, when we're not around to, you know, corroborate him. So I would, as part of my amends, I'd fly my mother out once a year, and, you know, bigger woman then, and she would I'd take her out to restaurants and stuff. So it's Easter Sunday. We have these great, great meals at my home, and my wife sets these beautiful tables. And so we're out, we made the table like a T, and I'm kind of sitting right here, and Greg is sitting right across from my mother. It's Easter, so it's ham, scalloped potatoes, you know, all the nice stuff. And so Greg says to my mother, she says, so Nathan tells me you stabbed his brother. Right? And my mother is very unstable. That could table flipping, pitcher of water in the face. Like, so everyone's like, uh-oh, right? So this kind of awkward silence goes by, and my mother says, well, their father was beating me up a lot at the time, so I started carrying a knife on me. And he moved quick, so I got him. And I like to say, that is the loving, nurturing home that I grew up in. My mother carried a knife on her, my brother moved quick, and she got him, right? That kind of summarizes the whole thing. Okay, so we're just in there drinking, getting high every single day. My mind is just always, maybe there was some fear there, but it was more like just like crazy, like a beehive all the time. Like, what are you thinking? What are you doing? What's that guy doing? What are you, just constant noise in my head. Right, just crazy, 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 just thoughts and volumes. And, you know, I moved around quick. I stuttered really bad as a kid. And here's why I drank. Because I had these four older brothers who were big, badass guys. They told people what to do, and they did it, right? And, they were kind of running stuff. And I wanted to feel in here the way they looked, right? I wanted my insides to feel the way their outsides looked. And when I drank alcohol, it made me feel like everything I thought a man should be, right? I was brave, I was strong, I was sexy. Like, I could talk to people. I absolutely, positively loved the effect produced by alcohol. I loved it, right? From 1975 to 1985, I did every single drug known to mankind. Every drug on the street, over and over, many times. Drugs not one single time ever made me feel the way alcohol made me feel every time, right? We're camping. One time we took a flashlight, a Michelob bottle fit right in there. We all dropped a few hits of window pane. Somebody said, beer light. And we just laughed for 6 hours, right? And it was fun. It was good. But alcohol would put me in the middle of the dance floor, in the middle. I could talk to people. I could talk to women. I could just, everything I could do sober, I could do 100 times better drinking. You know, the drugs were fine. I didn't really like the drugs that sped me up because I'm really moving too fast without them. I liked more the, you know, hallucinogenics. We smoked a lot of PCP and took a lot of acid, but, you know, I loved the effect produced by alcohol. So I drank. So I never pretended I had a family, a job, school, nothing. I didn't really go to school. I didn't work. You know, occasionally I'd get a job. I'd get paid. You know, you work for a week, you get paid, and like, job's over. I'm going partying. But pretty much we just, you know, committed crime and sold drugs to, you know, keep partying. That's pretty much all we did. And one just popped in my head. I was about 12. My brother prepped the back door in a house. I'm sure he'd been in this house. They gave me a list of what to go in and get. So it's like my first B&E. But they did the B part of the, I just did the entering part. So I went in there and I had to look for jewelry, medication. You know, they gave me like the little heads up what to do. There were a couple guns. I knew where they were, stole some guns. Remember, the last thing on the list to steal was to go into this kid's room and steal Black Sabbath Volume 4. Right? So that was my first burglary, right? And first of many. So anyway, you know, it's when you're doing, so I'm a little kind of intense. So when I drink, I get, the intensity level comes way up. And when the intensity level comes way up, the law enforcement, they're interested in people like me. So, you know, I just kept getting arrested. So I was in Bergen County Juvenile Detention, like, I don't know, 35, 40 times. I've never really done the math. I was in a little kid's jail for like 2 years, another little kid's jail for like 8 months. I was in 3 psychiatric hospitals and 4 drug and alcohol programs. So that's my drinking resume, right? So it was all kind of the same. I want to get through it kind of quick so I could talk about some sobriety. Sometimes I get hung up in that childhood home. There's a lot of funny stories there, but anyway, I got to get out of that. So there's this thing. It's like 3 felony convictions within a certain amount of time. You do a mandatory 15 years. It's kind of like a 3 strikes law in California. And I was the first juvenile in the state of New Jersey trying to prosecute under that crime. A few people didn't want to testify against me. The case fell apart. I turned 18. I went out. They're all behind assault charges. I picked up a pretty bad assault charge. I came back, and I got sentenced to 3 to 5 at like a medium. You know, I'm kind of working my way up in the prison system. So I'm waiting. I'm waiting to go. And my mother, growing up, and at this time was a very attractive woman, like just a beautiful, beautiful woman, very curvy. Knew how to play it, you know, and she knew what she was doing. And she dated half the bailiffs down at the courthouse because with me and my brother, she's in there all the time, right? So, I remember this one day because this is where things began to change. So one day she smoked those Virginia Slims and she's, you know, knows how to give them the eyes and she knows what she's doing, right? And she's out there. So I'm coming in. I have this light blue suit for court. Right, and I remember that day I looked down, it's kind of dirty and it's getting a little frayed, and I'm thinking, damn, I only wear this suit to court, and it was like worn out. And so I'm going in there, and my mother was happy and cracking up and joking. So I'm in there, and like a minute later, she's on my left, she's on this side. I remember this day so well. And you know how people, when they cry uncontrollably, my mother would have been an Academy Award winning actress. I mean, she's awesome. And you know how they're like they can't talk because they're like sobbing so hard. She's like sobbing, like, this is my baby. He never had a chance. And this judge hated me, hated my guts. And it's the judge's job to lock people like me up, right? People like me belong in prison. I was doing bad things to good people. I belonged locked up. I didn't belong out. And she's just going on and on. And, you know, back then the mascara ran. She looked like Ozzy Osbourne, you know. She's got, like, tear stains on her blouse. And she's like, she's just like, ah. And the judge is like, God damn it. So she found this the fourth drug and alcohol program for me to go to. And the judge gave me that, suspended the 3 to 5. And so I go to this place. And all the other places I'd been in had my medication. So I'd been on medication since like kindergarten, Ritalin and all kinds of pills they gave me I was in some mental hospitals and stuff. So I really never, ever really went a day without some kind of chemical floating around in there, right? And so I'm in this place, and it's all recovered people, no doctors, right? And so I'm like, yo, man, I need a little something, right? And they're like, nope. One threat, one act of violence, you're going to prison. So I'm in there, and I was the most miserable SOB you've ever met in your entire life. I mean, I was just, there were some rich kids in there. I'd steal their stuff and throw it in the dumpster because I knew they'd check my drawers. I just wanted to seem miserable, right? And so they'd be like checking my drawers, be like, why are you checking my drawers, right? Because they know who stole it, right? But so I'm in there, and so they said I never talked about my feelings. Just, if you know, where's that guy with the Yankees hat on? Yeah, you know, people from the East Coast, we don't have feelings, right? I got two feelings, horny and hungry, right? That's it. I was at this barbecue a couple weeks ago, and this kid, he's like 28 or something, talking about driving on this road that I guess had a cliff on it. He said it was giving him anxiety, and I'm just listening to this kid talking. I'm thinking, who talks like that? Like, what? If my kid ever talked like that, I'd slap him. Anyway. Just a joke. I've never hit my kids, but anyway, the I think about it though. But my thing was I had to sit in this circle. The family gets together, right? This is torture. This is like I'd rather have my fingernails ripped out than do this. So we'd get together, and I'd have to say three times a day before each meal, I'd have to say, letting people in is simply a matter of not expending the energy to keep people out. Then I'd have to say how I let somebody in that day. So I would say things like, today I let in Joey by telling him I think he's an asshole, right? And so the family votes me to leave, right? Because I was just not playing by the rules, not doing good. They vote me to leave. And so that night I'm laying in my bed, right? And, you know, for sure there's no fences. I'm going to go get wasted before the sheriff comes and gets me, right? It was Pennsylvania, New Jersey. Took a little bit to do the transportation. This old lady was working that night, Deborah Rogers, this old heroin addict, who's probably younger than I am now at the time, but from that perspective, she looked pretty old to me. So when things died down, I'm going to sneak out and go see what I can do. So all these old tapes are running through my head, right? Just tons of old tapes, like, my mother get back surgery, I steal her pills, I total two of my mother's cars. My sister, I'm kind of homeless, my sister lets me move in. She's renting a house with two other women, at the bottom of a two-family house. They put deadbolts on their doors before they let me move in. One day, I steal all their jewelry. My dad's high school ring, I sell for $14. Just all these little crappy little things I did, and all these bad things I did to get drugs and alcohol, right? And there's, you know, we all got hundreds of those stories, right? And a voice in my head says, if you didn't drink and you didn't use drugs, you wouldn't have all these problems. And up to that point in my life, I had never thought that drugs and alcohol were the reason my life was so screwed up. I thought it was the police, my family, New Jersey. I thought it was all these other things. I never thought it was drugs and alcohol. From that day to this, I've never been able to deny the fact that drugs and alcohol just about killed me. I took it almost as far as I could. So anyway, I stayed up all night talking to Deborah, that woman. She's really cool, and the family let me stay. And it was a six-month program. I graduated in 9 months, right? And so at the time, at the end of that, I didn't want to be sober, but I didn't want, like, So my drinking was always handcuffs and flashing lights and blood, right? And I wanted, you ever see like the beer commercials? You got the sexy people in California throwing frisbees, campfire, happy drinking, right? I want that kind of fun, happy drinking, right? Like sophisticated drinking. But so at the time, I'm like pretending like, oh yeah, I'm an alcoholic. I don't want to drink anymore. But I'm thinking, I can't wait to get a drink, right? So but I didn't want to go on the path. I knew the path I was on. I knew where it was leading. So I couldn't go to Jersey, couldn't stay. I was outside of Philly, and I had my oldest brother was in L.A. on the Jesus Patrol, right? So he was like going to church, and he couldn't drink and be with women, which were his two favorite things. So he was pretty tense back in them days. But God bless him. He had a tiny little single apartment in Santa Monica. He'd lean a mattress up on the floor during the day. Put it down at night, he'd have to step over me to get to the bathroom, but he never made me feel like I was putting him out. He let me stay there, and they said, go to an AA meeting, look for some guy who looks like he has what you want, ask him to be your sponsor, right? So I know nothing about AA, nothing. You know, some people would come in, panels would come into that place I was in, but I tuned him out. And so I go to this AA meeting, and I see this guy, he's speaking to three women, right? And I said, excuse me, would you be my sponsor? So he tells some funny stories about me, right? He was like, we're at his apartment. Looking back now, I know that he was trying to work the steps with me, and he wanted me to kneel down with him and do the third step. And it's like, me and him alone in the apartment. I'm like, no. And I left, right? So then like a day or two later, I don't know, I meet some girl. We're hanging out. She's like, I feel like getting loaded. I'm like, you're not the only one. So now I was sober for a little while because I had that time in that rehab and a few months in L.A. Maybe, you know, I wasn't really keeping good notes, but I think it's about a year I had, right? And so I had this job. I was working at this printing place, and, you know, I'm really intense. Like, I do competition. Like, if you can do that much work in an hour, I can do that much work plus 10% in an hour better, right? And so, like, bosses, they don't care why you're working like that. They just think, this dude's humping. We're making some money off of him. So they sent me back to get trained on these machines in Virginia. And so I remember the first night with her, smoked some weed, right? And so it's after being sober about a year. And I planned to drink, right? And I go to drink normally. And so I go, okay, I'm going to get on this plane. They're spending a lot of money to train me. I want to do a good job. So I'm not going to drink on the plane. I'm going to get back there. And then I see the lady pushing the cart, and the cart like goes super slow. You know, we've been on planes. So I'm like, two, please. And so I get two drinks. I get to the hotel, and I got a little bag and a big bag. I remember checking in. I'm like, where's the bar? So I don't even go to my room. I take my bags to the bar, right? So this is day two after being sober about a year. Drink a few pitchers of beer, play a little pool, no fights, no lights, everything's good. I'm like, I got it. I go back to my room, go to class the next day, kicking ass, right? Everything's good. School's over. Day three, getting loaded. They're like, hey, we're going into town. Do you need anything? I'm like, yeah. I need a fifth, the Smirnoff Blue Label, and a little bit of OJ, right? And I remember they gave me kind of a weird look, and I'm like, get going. So I sat out in this little common area in the hotel, and remember I had about that much left in the bottom of the fifth, thinking, oh yeah, I can still drink. Took a year off and I can still drink. And then it's just a blur, right? It's just a blur. So I had a car, a motorcycle, a little apartment, had the rudimentary beginnings of a life, and it just evaporated. So we think it's about 6 months, right? I'm pretty sure it's about 6 months. I'm living on my drug dealer's floor in Venice with my stripper girlfriend, right? It's February 16th, 1985. She's like, you're a loser. I'm going back to Vegas. And the guy's like, I've been fighting a lot and getting crazy, and he's selling drugs, so not a good mix. He's like, you got to go. So I go down to Venice Beach, me and my pillowcase with some clothes in it and my bicycle. And I'm like, you know, obviously I'm not opposed to crime, but I'm not like a purse snatcher. Like, I want crime that pays. Right. And so it's like Disney. I'm from Jersey, Venice Beach. I'm like, what the hell? And so my brother, Mike, he had flunked out of a rehab in Denver and took up my mattress in Fran's apartment. So I call up Mike. I'm like, give me some money. Right. And I forget it. We both talked about it. It went something like this. He's like, call me back in 10 minutes. So I call him back. I'm like, give me some money. Like, all I needed was like $20 to start drinking. And I can take it from there, right? So he goes, check it out. One chance only. You drink again, don't ever call me again. So I'm thinking, this sounds weird. So he goes, I'll get you a place to stay. I'll get your old job back. You go to a meeting every night. I remember thinking, you dick. I'm gonna beat your head in with a baseball bat. I'm literally gonna beat you to death, you SOB. Like, I was so flippin' angry. But I had nobody else would take a call from me. And it's like California, like, where do you go? Like, I didn't even know where to go. If I was in Jersey, I could have got it started. But out here, I didn't know where to go. So I had no choice but to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and to pretend to be an alcoholic. My plan was to save up enough money to buy a couple ounces of cocaine, start selling drugs again, and this time not screw up, right? And so people used to say, you gotta want it when you come here. Well, I didn't want it, and I told you what you could do with it when I got here. I was the meanest, nastiest newcomer you could imagine. Like, I just, you know, they'd say, will you read chapter 5 tonight? I'd be like, nope. They'd say, you can't say no to an AA request. I'd be like, call my name, I'll walk out that back door. Try me. And so I just didn't. I didn't get it. I didn't get along. I hated it. I absolutely hated being here. Hated being forced to come here. Didn't want to be here. And just like my mind, every minute of every single day. Like, you want to talk about an obsession? Every minute of every day, I thought of three things: drinking, homicide, and sex. That's it. Just all I thought about. It was just miserable. And it lasted for about 8 months. Like, I didn't, so then I get sober in the Pacific group. I know nothing about nothing. My brother Mike, my uncle hooked up Mike with Clancy, so Mike gets sober in the Pacific group. So now these meetings, I gotta go to Pacific group meetings, which, looking back now, it's the luckiest thing that could ever happen to me. But when you're there, there's just all these people talking to you and invading your personal space and just like, get off me, you know? And so I'm at a meeting, and this old guy just starts breaking my balls, right? You know, like you gotta cut your hair, you gotta shave, we don't dress like that in AA meetings. And I remember, like, you know, I have the fundamental training of a human, like, respect your elders. So I'm trying to be nice to him and walk away from the guy. And I'm just thinking, like, who is this guy? Right? Like, and, you know, so I have no memory of him asking to be me asking him to be my sponsor, or him saying, I'll be your interim sponsor, or whatever they say. Like, just one day he just starts telling me all this stuff to do. Right? And so I'm like, here's one of the great mysteries of my life. You know, there's no AA police, right? There's no AA, you don't listen to your sponsor. Nobody can make you listen to your sponsor, right? The way I grew up, like, if you could beat my ass, I listen to you. If I could beat your ass, you listen to me. In 1985, in the Pacific group, nobody could make me do anything I didn't want to do. So for some reason, I listened to this guy to the best of my screwed up ability. Right, my ability back then was very, very, very bad. But for some reason, I think that my brother was in the group and a couple other guys I thought were legit in the group. And I thought, you know, I don't know, maybe. I didn't even know what my thinking was. I just started kind of stepping in line and walking in line and doing all that. You know, this guy, he wanted me to go to 15 meetings a week. So the morning meeting, work, the PG-19 meeting, nighttime meeting, and three meetings on Sunday. And for 2 years, I went to pretty much three meetings a week, 15 meetings a week. And so, like, I did these things. I tried doing the steps. I didn't do them right. But my life improved. It got better and better and better. Turns out, if you're an alcoholic and you take the actions don't care why you take them, right? It's going to work. If you're an alcoholic, this thing's going to work for you, whether you believe in it or not. I did not believe in it. I didn't want it. But I just, you know, God, if you ever wonder, like, if I ever wonder about God and God's mercy, my life is the best example of the existence of God. I did really, 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 really bad things to people, and I live this amazing life today. I believe in God's mercy. I believe in God's forgiveness, right? So August 12th, 1990. So I moved back to Jersey because I can't take these fruity Californians, right? So I'm back in Jersey. I'm at a Monday night Demarest meeting, Demarest, New Jersey, chilling, minding my own business. August 12th, 1991. Really good looking woman walks by. You know, it's Jersey, so I'm like, what's up? So we start dating, and we fall in love, get engaged. And her brother, who I was locked up with plenty of times, did some drinking with him. He literally, when we got engaged, he got on a plane. He flew up to New Jersey to tell Trish in person, do not marry Nathan Dixon, right? You know, them AA women, she's like, I got to get me that now. But, I remember the day we met because it was my birthday. She says it's the best birthday present I ever got. So we got married, and I was actually working in New Jersey. I'm working one day, and I've had these, I don't know if they're intuitive thoughts or inspirational moments. Sometimes when I'm feeling really spiritual, maybe I'll put some weird names on them, but I just had this overwhelming sense that if I stayed in New Jersey, I was going to drink. The AA meetings where I grew up are not like the AA meetings in California. People don't stay sober a long time. They drink near beer. They go to strip clubs after the meetings. They're just doing stuff that is not conducive to staying sober for a long time, right? And so I just knew. I said, I got to move back to California. So I moved back. I left New Jersey, moved back to L.A. for the single reason to be in the Pacific Group. So Trish, my girlfriend at the time, she's like, you know, everybody says you're kind of nuts. It's probably for the best anyway that we don't do it. So I'm like, I got to go. I'm going to drink if I stay in New Jersey, and then it really won't be good. So I'm out here, and she's flying out, and we're talking, and so I'm like, you could move to California if you want. And she's like, I'm not moving without a ring. Right? So that's how we got engaged. We got married. Women have their ways of kind of getting what they want out of men. But anyway, we got married September 3rd, 1994. So this September 3rd will be 30 years we've been married. Right? Young kids in AA. Don't thank me. Thank her. I'm not the easiest guy to be married to. And we had May 9th, 96, she gave birth to twin boys. And then May 2nd, 2001, she delivered our third son, Danny. And it's been this amazing. So I like to say a couple things, like if I had more time, I don't know. Time seemed to go by quick tonight. But one of the things we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is we repair shattered lives. Like, my life was fragmented, destroyed, was just destroyed. And in AA, it's been put back together, right? And another thing that happens here, dreams come true in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And as a kid, I got my ass beat, like crazy, kind of weird, kind of abusive kind of stuff. And one of the ways I got through it was I used to fantasize about having a family. Right, and when it was more than a fantasy. I almost had this belief that it was going to happen. Sometimes I think I might have just believed in it happening, but like it got me through a lot of stuff. This kind of like I would just have this, like I'd go to this fantasy land of this family. So we get married, and you know, she's an alcoholic, right? She's you know, she got her own things. I got my problems. Have problems. I'm so screwed up, right? And but we start this family with these three boys, and we're like that family, right? The minivan, I coach all the teams. She's the team mom with the little clipboard and the snacks and all that stuff. And, you know, my kids go to a little Catholic private school, and then 2 minutes. And then they went to all-boys Catholic high school, and all three of my kids graduated college. Two played little D1 schools. They played football, and you know, I absolutely loved being a parent. I loved it. And I was crazy, right? I was their coach. So like fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh grade, my flag football teams were just, we won CYO every year. Like some dads would go out with the little whiteboard and draw up a play. All my kids had wristbands. and I'd rotate my receivers, and from when the ref stopped a play, we could get a playoff in 18 seconds. We practiced that thing, and it was just awesome. I would coach travel baseball, right? And we would just be, I just had these really talented teams, and it was just fun coaching my kids, watching my kids, and you know, it's just been a great life. So now, you know, COVID was a little bogus. I mean, it didn't really bother me because, you know, the lockdown came out, and I'm like, you know, I've been working my ass off for years. I'm a carpenter by trade. I work as a contractor. I got a pretty decent company going. Trish does the books. I run the field and all the crews, and you know, it's good. It's been a good job for us, and something. I've been working a long time. I deserve a few weeks off, right? She's like, opens up that laptop. She's like, nope, you're an essential worker. You got to go to work. She doesn't want me around the house coaching her up during the day, right? And then I'm like, I can't watch meetings on my iPad. You know, like I sponsor some guys on Wednesday night. We would cook them dinner. We try to watch the Pacific group, you know, my home group, and everybody would be talking. I'm like, hey, man, treat it like a meeting. You know, it'd just be like anarchy. So we had this meeting at my house, and then Clancy heard I had a meeting in my backyard. So, of course, he wanted one. Got it. I'm done. So I got to go to 3 meetings a week during COVID. But anyway, I'm out of time. If you're new, I know it seems kind of weird. Like, it seems like this thing doesn't really apply to your life. If you're alcoholic, I swear to you, I promise you, this is the answer to every problem you've ever had. Like, if you can somehow surrender your will to your sponsor's will, follow his stupid, idiotic direction to the best of your ability, your life will change and you'll stay sober. Thank you. Good evening.